And welcome back to Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis. Let's start off the second half of tonight's show with some commentary. This is written by Scott Stouter and is entitled, For Rivers to Have Salmon, Salmon Must Have Rivers. In Salmon Without Rivers, Jim Likatowicz, a 30-year-old Northwest fishery biologist, does what others haven't had the courage to do. He ties the myth that has guided our history of salmon management to our cultural separation from the natural world and brands the marriage as the root cause of pushing Northwest salmon to the abyss of extinction. For 120 years, we've been the willing supporters of a blind and devastating false doctrine that hatcheries could substitute for overharvest and destruction of natural habitat, Likatowicz said. At a reading of his book in Corvallis, Oregon, we assumed that we could control the biological productivity of salmon and improve upon natural processes that we didn't even try to understand. We assumed we could have salmon without rivers. Likatowicz says the huge appetites of commercial salmon canneries, especially on the Columbia River, caused politicians and businessmen to grasp the sharp edge of the hatchery sword in the late 1800s to keep from drowning in their own greed. Nobody believed that harvest restrictions could be enforced, he said, so fishery managers searched for a way to increase salmon without restricting the harvest. In 1875, Congress appointed Spencer Baird, a Smithsonian scientist, as director of the newly formed Commission on Fish and Fisheries. Baird quickly identified the three threats to Northwest salmon: overharvest, dams, and habitat destruction. Because he didn't consider it possible to stop the threats, he took to the fledgling fish culture program on the Sacramento River for another answer. Ironically, he mistakenly identified as a solution what would become the final threat, hatcheries. Today, Baird's paradigm is known collectively as the four H's, harvest, habitat, hydro, and hatcheries of the salmon equation. His hatchery solution would become the altar upon which the other three threats would come to roost. Likatowicz points to Baird's fundamental flaw of reasoning that humans can control nature and destroy it at the same time as the genesis of our present crisis with salmon. Based on this limited and incomplete experiment, the Sacramento River Fish Hatchery, Baird made a dangerous and gigantic scientific leap, Likatowicz says. He unhesitatingly recommended that, instead of passing laws to protect fish and habitat, that hatcheries could be established on the Columbia River. Industry politicians and salmon managers seized this easy alternative to restrictions on harvest and resource extraction, and hatcheries expanded across the Northwest. Thus, with absolutely no scientific evidence to support his recommendation, Spencer Baird launched a myth in a program that has lasted over 100 years and is still destroying salmon, Likatowicz says. It wouldn't be till 1922, when the U.S. and Canada joined efforts to study whether hatcheries really worked, that science could test the assumption of the hatchery success. And to avoid redundancy, the research was done in Canada's Fraser River Basin by Canadian biologist Russell Forrester. After more than 50 years of hatchery operation, Forrester would finally test the basic premise underlying their use, that artificial propagation was more efficient and successful than natural propagation. Likatowicz states the salmon without rivers. Nearly 14 years later, Forrester's research concluded that hatcheries weren't the magic wand, that artificial propagation was not significantly different than natural propagation. Canada immediately closed all of its hatcheries and concentrated on protecting natural habitat, Likatowicz says. The United States ignored the research. Today, Canada's Fraser River, which has been spared main stem dams and is still relying on natural production, has salmon returning to near historical numbers, about 22 million sockeye returned in 1990. In contrast, Columbia River salmon are poised on the edge of extinction. Likatowicz says the increased percentage of hatchery fish as compared to the number of wild fish in the Columbia is a false measure of success. As the total number of wild fish in the Columbia Basin declined, hatchery salmon began to make up larger percentages of the total population, he notes in his book. Today, as proof of their success, hatchery advocates note that hatchery salmon make up 80% or more of the total number of Columbia salmon, but they fail to mention the total run has crashed to less than 5% of its historical abundance. By mid-century, after subsequent studies of artificial propagation on the Columbia River, the American Fisheries Society and prominent fish scientists backed Forrester's research. But the ideological and political underpinnings of the American hatchery program prevented fishery agencies from acknowledging the consequences of the Canadian study. So why have we doggedly supported hatchery production instead of promoting habitat protection and harvest restrictions? Liketowicz points to ecological ignorance and arrogant adherence to a dominant cultural ideology. He says a lack of fishery science early in the formation of wildlife agencies propagated the myth that salmon could be raised like chickens. He quotes wildlife biologist Durwood Allen, who describes old-line gamekeepers and fish culturists as skilled artisans who didn't hesitate to defend their practices of artificially raising birds and fish in terms of game in the bag and fish in the creel. They got away with it, said Allen, because we, the sportsmen, didn't know where their livestock rearing knowledge ended and their ecological ignorance began. They didn't either, and they reacted instinctively against anything that appeared to call their art to question. Liketowicz documents that the preponderance of research now shows, but what we're afraid to admit, salmon hatcheries don't work. They never have worked, and we don't know enough about the intricate balance of aquatic ecosystems to make them work. The only thing hatcheries have given us is a false shield behind which we can pile our collective guilt and greed for destroying ecosystems. If we want to save salmon, we have to give them back their rivers. Today in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and California, salmon, one of the most resilient and tenacious creatures ever to grace the waters of this planet, are now extinct in nearly 40% of their historic rivers. In half of the remaining streams, populations are on the brink of extinction. This massive extermination is unmatched by any geological event in the past 40 million years since the bones of the earliest known salmonid settled into the mud of a lake in British Columbia. From the fiery formation of the continents to the grinding centuries of the ice ages, salmon have survived, evolved, and persevered. But in less than two centuries, our thoughtless plunge into a civilization based on arrogant disregard of natural processes has brought these creatures to their knees. Salmon without rivers strips away the layers of social and political rhetoric to the raw reasons we have destroyed our salmon. Caught in the web of our own technological myth, we've created a cultural story that denies our relationship with nature. It has been a story with a very simple plot. Control, simplify, dominate, and artificialize salmon and their rivers, Liketowicz states. If we are to save salmon, we will have to change our story. The one we have now doesn't have a happy ending. This was a commentary written by Scott Stouter entitled For Rivers to Have Salmon, Salmon Must Have Rivers. If you'd like to contact Scott, you can call him at 541-929-5844. That's 541-929-5844. And moving into animal news, two U.S. sea turtle protection groups and a Bahamian coalition have called on San Francisco-based Bechtel, Families Realty Group, to withdraw funding from a controversial luxury development project in the Bahamas. The Sea Turtle Restoration Project, the Caribbean Conservation Corporation, and Clifton Park Committee are asking the Bechtel family not to invest in a project that could be detrimental to endangered sea turtles in an area where a national conservation area is being proposed. Funds are being sought to create a national conservation area to protect the sea turtles and other resources. We need the Bechtel family to withdraw its funding from this luxury development so that these unique natural resources can be protected, said Dave Godfrey, director of the CCC, that is the Caribbean Conservation Corporation based in Florida. A proposal for a $400 million high-density gated community for foreigners known as Clifton Bay has outraged some Bahamians who fear the development will destroy or harm the nearby wetlands, tropical hardwood forests, and valuable reefs and dive sites. Endangered green turtles, hawksbills, and loggerhead turtles feed on the nearshore reefs and seagrass beds around Clifton. The developers are being financed by Fremont Realty Capital of San Francisco. The Bechtel family is the driving force behind Fremont Realty Capital, which is providing the financing for the project. The board of directors of the Fremont Group include Stephen Bechtel, Riley Bechtel, the current CEO and chairman of Bechtel Corporation, former U.S. Secretary of State George Shultz, and several members of the Bechtel Corporation. Six grizzly bears have been killed by humans this year in Wyoming outside of Yellowstone National Park, compared to one last year, according to the Wyoming Game and Fish Department. Bears have increased in number and distribution, and so it's inevitable that people and bears are going to run into each other, and occasionally bears will become aggressive with people, said Mark Brascino, game and fish biologist Grizzly deaths increased, but human-bear interaction and property damage is down. Bear deaths could not have been higher if not for the Game and Fish Department's campaign aimed at informing backcountry users on ways to avoid encounters, Bruscino said. Outfitters and guides have also helped clients learn bear avoidance. The education campaign has probably saved some bears' lives and prevented injuries to people, he said. Still, environmentalists say that the 6 grizzly bear deaths this year could have been prevented. From Nepal, shocked by the fact that 42 one-horned rhinoceroses roaming the Royal Chitwan National Park have died in the last 15 months, officials of Nepal's Department of National Parks and Wildlife Conservation have announced a detailed investigation into the cause of this loss. We are all set to start a research on rhinos, their habitat, and other factors in Chitwan Park. We are going to conduct rhino census there late this month, and other studies, too, will follow, promised Department of National Parks and Wildlife Conservation Director Dr. Tirthman Maski. Preliminary findings reveal the rhinos' deaths were mostly due to poaching and poisoning. Officials say this is the first time in 10 years that the endangered one-horned rhinoceros, living in one of the finest habitats in Asia, have suffered such a large number of deaths in little more than a year's time. Department officials told journalists that a total of 5 rhinos were killed by poachers. 6 others were found killed by villagers living in the park's buffer zone. 3 were poisoned and 3 electrocuted by angry villagers because the rhinos frequently destroy their crops. Similarly, 2 rhinos died after they were swept away by floods during the monsoon this year, while two others died by drowning. 9 rhinos died as a result of mutual fighting, while 1 was killed by a tiger and another dead rhino was found hanging on a gabion wire, according to wildlife officials. The department says the remaining 10 rhinos died of natural causes. Between 10 and 15 rhinos do die of natural causes every year. And a total of 14 rhinos died during the period of 1997 to 1998, while the death toll stood at 9 last year, the records show. And responding to a federal court order, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has proposed to designate 894 miles of rivers and streams in Arizona and New Mexico as critical habitat for 2 threatened fish species, the spike dace and the loach minnow. Critical habitat refers to areas essential for the conservation of a threatened or endangered species and which may require special management considerations. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service designated critical habitat for the 2 species in 1994, but it was rescinded in 1998 after a federal court determined that such critical habitat designations must comply with the National Environmental Policy Act. Responding to a lawsuit filed by the Southwest Center for Biological Diversity, the U.S. District Court then ordered the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to reconsider the designation of critical habitat, perform all NEPA compliance requirements, and develop Endangered Species Act biological and economic justifications by February 17th of next year. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife is asking the public to provide written comments on this proposal by January 24th of next year. Comments should be submitted to Field Supervisor, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, 2321 West Royal Palm Road, Suite 103, Phoenix, Arizona, 85021. Once again, that address for comments on critical habitat designation for the spike dace and the loach minnow along 894 miles of rivers and streams in Arizona and New Mexico is Field Supervisor, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, 2321 West Royal Palm Road, Suite 103, Phoenix, Arizona, 85021. And unfortunately, the public hearings have ended, so you're going to have to make written comments. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has listed Gentner's fritillary, one of Oregon's rarest native plants, as endangered under the Federal Endangered Species Act. A species is considered endangered if it is at risk of becoming extinct throughout all or a significant portion of its range. Gentner's fritillary, already listed as endangered by the state of Oregon, is a showy lily that has red bell-shaped flowers with pale yellow streaks. The plant grows about 2 feet tall and occurs only in the rural foothills of the Rogue and the Illinois River valleys in Jackson and Josephine counties in southern Oregon. It prefers the edge of open woodlands and thrives on infrequent but regular disturbances, such as occur during historic wildfire patterns. Only 340 of these uniquely beautiful plants are known to exist, said Ann Badgley of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Center's Pacific Regional Office. The service will work with the state of Oregon and other partners to put the species back from the brink of extinction and recover it to a healthy population. The remaining plants face diverse threats, including logging, digging of bulbs by horticulturists seeking to cultivate rare species, predation through wildlife fungal infection, loss of habitat due to fire suppression, road building and maintenance, conservation of habitat to cropland, and trampling by hikers, bikers, and horses. Biologists have found the species at only 45 sites, and only 8 of those are larger than an acre. 13 of the sites are on Bureau of Land Management lands, 5 on state lands, 7 on City of Jacksonville lands, and 20 are on private lands. And removing small hydroelectric dams is often the most effective way to help the environment and save money, says a coalition of U.S. environmental groups. More than 465 dams have been removed across the United States, and the restored rivers produce better fish habitat, yield financial savings, improve public safety, and revitalize communities, according to a report released by American Rivers, Friends of the Earth, and Trout Unlimited. When folks hear about how successful these dam removals were, we hope more communities, dam owners, and natural resource managers will consider removing dams on their local rivers as one reasonable way to restore them to health and revitalize the communities along their banks, said Margaret Bowman of American Rivers. The report, entitled Dam Removal Success Stories, Restoring Rivers Through Selective Removal of Dams That Don't Make Sense, includes 25 detailed case studies of dam removals. The groups call it the most comprehensive review to date of the history and benefits of dam removal in the United States. And from France, Kroon Mather, the captain of the oil tanker Erica that broke up in two off the Brittany coast last Sunday, is in the custody of police in Brest, France, charged with endangering the lives of others and with maritime pollution. Mather was in charge of the Maltese-registered Erica on its way from the Netherlands to Italy when it foundered in rough seas on the Bay of Biscay. About 10,000 tons of its crude oil cargo has been spilled into the sea off northwestern France. The French company Totalfina, which supplied the 30,000 tons of oil the Erica was transporting, could also face prosecution, authorities said. The stern section of the vessel sank Monday. The forward half has been towed out into deeper water. Both halves of the ship still have thousands of tons of oil on board. French authorities are considering the feasibility of dumping the remaining oil off into other vessels, but continued stormy weather is making the implementation of any such plans impossible for the present. Christophe Rousseau, the deputy head of CEDAR, a special research center on oil sea pollution, said the main slick, estimated at between 8,000 and 10,000 tons of oil, has drifted to within 60 kilometers, that's about 35 miles, of the French coast. And in Vietnam, environmentalists are blaming widespread illegal logging as a factor in the disastrous flooding that has hit the central coast of Vietnam for the second time in 2 months. Flooding rainfall that began December 1st is blamed for 115 deaths and injuries to 120 others. More than 5,000 homes have been swept away, and nearly 400,000 more homes have been inundated and damaged, the United Nations officials report. The latest flood struck just a month after the central coast provinces of Vietnam were inundated by the worst floods in the country has experienced this century, in which 592 people lost their lives. These new floods occurred just as rehabilitation measures were being undertaken in order to help stabilize the lives of the people in the central provinces. And a spokesman for the World Wildlife Fund says the government and provincial authorities are aware of the need to protect the forests and have been active in programs to plant more trees, but at the same time, illegal logging has been stripping forests from the steep mountain ranges not far inland from the flooded area. Less than 10% of Vietnam is covered by primary forest, but those remaining natural forest and grassland areas still hold viable populations of many rare species. The World Wildlife Fund project works to expand the information base on mammals and other important species and ecosystems and strengthen Vietnam's system of protected areas and ecological reserves. And from New Zealand, environmentalists are celebrating the success of newly elected New Zealand government in forcing the government-owned logging company Timberlands to withdraw its plans to log extensive areas of beech rainforest on the west coast of the country's South Island. In defiance of the new government's views, Timberlands Monday pressed ahead with the opening of public hearings into an application for approval of new rainforest logging proposals. Late in the afternoon, several hours after the hearings commenced, Timberlands was directed by the new ministers to withdraw its logging application. The shareholding ministers, the minister responsible for Timberlands, Pete Hodgson, and Finance Minister Michael Cullen, wrote to the Timberlands Board of Directors directing them to exclude beech logging, that's beech tree logging, from the firm's statement of corporate intent. Timberland's restless campaign for the new logging proposals has angered the Labor and Alliance parties, which were sworn into government last Friday after the finalization of the election count. Earlier this year, leaked documents revealed a multi-million dollar covert lobbying campaign by Timberlands and its PR firm Shandwick to lobby political parties and neutralize likely opposition. Early last week, Timberlands Chairman Warren Young was asked by the outgoing government of former Prime Minister Jenny Shipley to suspend work on its application and the public hearings until the new government had been sworn in and could meet with Timberlands. Young refused. As I have said continuously, as and when the government directs us not to proceed, we will respond accordingly. But until that point is reached, we intend to press ahead with the hearings as scheduled, he said. Immediately after the new government was sworn in last Friday, Cullen and Hodgson's met with Young and requested that the application for new logging approvals be withdrawn. Young refused once more, insisting that Timberlands was legally obliged to continue with its application. Over the weekend, the ministers obtained legal advice and, after meeting with Young once more, wrote to him directing that Timberlands amend its business charter to exclude beech tree forest logging. Finally, the company obeyed. Environmentalists who were scheduled to give evidence before the hearing later this week have welcomed the decision. This Christmas, conservationists can celebrate the fact that the 25-year campaign to protect the magnificent beech forest and wildlife of North Westland, the Grey Valley, and Boolerk is close to success, Forest and Bird Field Officer Eugenie Sage said. And from Australia, Australian officials may face a revolt if they impose an immediate ban to stop rapid tree clearing by Queensland farmers anxious about pending land protection measures. Farmers fear that planned restrictions on the regional forest agreement could force them off their property. At a panicked pace, they have removed more than 300,000 hectares, that's 1,158 square miles of native vegetation, officials said. Regional forest agreements are agreements between the state and Commonwealth governments to set certain lands aside for conservation and allow logging on other designated lands. Queensland state government Wednesday introduced legislation to restrict the ability of farmers to clear native vegetation on freeholded land. The new law aims to stop what has escalated to be among the highest rates of forest clearance in the world. It is intended to prevent further loss of habitat and limit the state's contributions to greenhouse gas emissions. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have here on Earth First Radio. To get your news, announcements, or comments from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, please send us email at cruzief@cruzio.com. That's cruzief, C-R-U-Z-E-F, @cruzio.com. Or send your letters, donations, CDs, or cassettes to Earth First Radio. We're at P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Once again, that's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Uncle Dennis would like you to send all your announcements at least 3 weeks in advance. I hate to read announcements about events that have already occurred. If you'd like more in-depth news and information about the Earth First movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. Their address, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. That's the Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. Earth First Radio is broadcast live on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, every Thursday evening at 8 p.m. Or you can listen to Earth First Radio anytime on your computer. We're on the World Wide Web at radioforall.web.net. That's radio, followed by the number 4, followed by all, radioforall.web.net. You'll need a sound card in your computer, but the software you need is free for downloading at the website. Earth First Radio is being rebroadcast on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations. If you found us on the web, ask your local station to download and rebroadcast Earth First Radio. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney from the CD Keep It Wild. Earth First Radio is affiliated with the Earth First Radio Network. I'm Uncle Dennis. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again. I want to play this one in honor of the World Trade Organization. It's Daryl Cherney's song, Xerox the Money.
For a Xerox machine, 'cause what they do is Xerox the money.